Welcome to The Machine. This is the Liberty Machine Unleashed podcast. I am your host, Richard Heathen, with LibertyMachineNews.com, coming to you from the enemy-occupied island of Vancouver. This is episode 24 of the program titled, America or Israel First? As we know, the United States bombed a Syrian airfield on Thursday, April 6th, in response to an alleged sarin gas attack on civilians by the Assad regime. Trump campaigned against nation building and against policing the world. So why did Trump do a complete 180 on foreign policy? Who benefits? We'll be going over that later. But before we get to today's guest, I want to address a few things. People out there are declaring this the end of Trumpism, and it may very well be. With the marginalization of Steve Bannon's influence, the rise of Jared Kushner, and the recent attacks on Syria, it doesn't look good. It's both funny and demoralizing to see Trump's tweets from 2013, where he criticized then-President Obama for doing the very same thing he's doing right now, bombing Syria after an alleged gas attack on civilians. Regardless of this betrayal, I don't regret supporting Trump. People are forgetting the very real cultural victories we've had during this campaign. The left has shown their true nature and how unhinged they really are. We've also exposed the frailty of the so-called cultural Marxist consensus. So-called consensus, I should say. We've shown that they do not hold sway over the minds of at least half the population, at least not enough to make them vote for Hillary Clinton. We've organized, we've networked, and we've built alliances together. In my mind, Trump's campaign was never about him. It was about us and the preservation of Western civilization. Trump's campaign was iconic only because he was able to tap into something already stirring in the cultural zeitgeist and gave a voice to something simmering in the collective unconscious of all of Western civilization, not just America. If he's abandoned us, so what? We move on and continue. I always knew that this was a very real and distinct possibility. To be honest, I thought it would take a little longer for him to be completely co-opted by the establishment and the deep state. I suppose I underestimated the power of the cathedral. If you're confused by my use of the term cathedral, it's a neo-reactionary term. Search for it on Google to get a full understanding of what I'm talking about. Regardless, though, of how disappointing Trump's turn to the dark side is, it's something we should have all been prepared for. The only option we have now is to carry on. Not long after bombs were dropped in Syria, I was able to interview Ryan Dawson of ANC Report to discuss exactly what the situation was on the ground, who benefits, as well as the history of the Israeli lobby. Let's go to that interview now. All right, well, thanks for joining me, Ryan.
Not a problem.
And yeah, so we've got breaking news. It's a brand new story. The United States government under President Donald Trump just launched 59 Tomahawk missiles at an airfield in Syria.
Yes, he did. He annihilated it, took out 15 aircraft. And as it stands right now, there have been 4 casualties on top of that.
Oh, that's not good. So why don't you give us some background about this and why... You know, there's supposedly a sarin gas attack. Why don't you give us your perspective on that?
Well, yeah, it's something else because the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, as well as the President himself, Donald Trump, had stated as recently as just 4 days ago that it's up to the Syrian people to determine their own future, that they finally stop this Assad must go rhetoric. And since Trump has been president, he's actually been going after al-Nusra. He's been doing real damage to ISIS and to these terrorist groups. But then there was this sarin gas attack, and it got blamed on Assad. You know, while the victims were still coughing, they said it must have been Assad. Now, that attack doesn't make any sense for a number of reasons. There's no motive. There's no real evidence either, but... No way in the middle of a war that Assad is winning is he going to use an outlawed chemical weapon, especially after back in 2003, this almost exact same scenario happened, although it did turn out after investigations that the rebels had used the gas. It didn't matter at the time. They blamed it on Assad, And the media was so uniform in that. Assad's a monster, Assad must go, but that's how the Zionist media is. I mean, they're just, that's their agenda. And so Assad dismantled his stockade of chemical weapons that he had not used. The only reason Syria had them in the first place was as a deterrent against Israel's weapons of mass destruction, since they have nuclear weapons. So he dismantled them, and it didn't matter. It was used as a pretext for the U.S. to get more involved anyway. And so Congress would not approve ground troops in Syria, and so the U.S. was doing airstrikes. And the reason Congress couldn't approve it is because Americans actually, for once, gathered up together and called by the thousands, almost 1,000 to 1 against the AIPAC, that was the ratio, saying we do not want to go in Syria, because after the lies that led to the war in Iraq, the American people were fed up with it. They didn't want another war. They saw what happened in Libya. It's a disaster. They saw what happened in Iraq was a disaster. And they were not going to be able to be – they're just not accepting what the government was selling them. But after the gas attack, the U.S. got a little foot in the door to allow airstrikes, supposedly against the extremists, although they accidentally have been bombing the Syrian military. They did that last September. They killed 62 people, injured 100 more. And they said it was we hit the wrong targets. And they've been helping al-Qaeda groups. Now, they can't publicly say we're there to help al-Qaeda. Just like during Iran-Contra, they denied it the whole time. They denounced them, but privately they were funding them the whole time. And this is the same sort of scenario, same methods of finance too, where the U.S. and their allies are covertly financing and giving logistical and material support to these rebel groups, and there are no moderate rebels. So that's what's been going on leading up to this incident. And then things started to change when Trump became president. He started actually attacking the Islamic State, al-Nusra Front. He named al-Sham and the terrorist watch list and so forth. Then he pulled him on 80. Like, all these neocons have gotten to him, because after this most recent gas attack, which is horrible, and there's pictures of the dead children, and it's like the U.S. cares about children when they starve so many to death in Iraq and have burned so many in Fallujah, and that's something else that they pontificate about the children. The U.S. has murdered children all over the world. But that said, this is on film. That's the difference. People see pictures of these children. They don't see pictures of the children in Iraq or Vietnam, Korea, or any of the other stages of war. The U.S. has murdered people by the hundreds of thousands. So it had an emotional impact, and without allowing any time for investigation, he said, it must have been Assad, so we're going to do a strike on the airbase where we believe that these chemical weapons were delivered from, and they think that there were stockpiles of weapons. Now, the Syrian side of it is they're saying they did not use chemical weapons, that they probably bombed a plant where the rebels had been stockpiling chemical weapons, and so it was released that way. Maybe the rebels just gassed some kids and blamed it on Assad. That seems the most likely scenario, but there's really no motive or evidence. There wasn't time for an investigation. Nothing was given. As soon as the U.S. Naval ships were in place, they fired cruise missiles and take out an entire air base in Syria. And we're getting word now that ISIL has used this opportunity to attack that same area. So we have just acted as al-Qaeda's air force, and al-Qaeda is now using that airstrike, well, not airstrike, cruise missile strike, as an advantage to gain ground over their ground forces.
Well, that is absolutely horrible. Why do you suppose, and I know I'm asking you to guess on another human being's perspective or why they've changed their minds, but why do you suppose changed? Why do you think Trump changed his strategy, changed his position? What do you think changed?
I think a couple things. So Trump kind of backed himself into a corner. This is a very egotistical man, very narcissistic, names everything after himself, Trump airplane, Trump steak, Trump tower, Trump whatever. He's made himself into a brand, been successful though, but he kind of talked himself into a corner because he criticized the former president, Barack Obama, so much about creating these red lines and saying you can't make idle threats. You know, if you say, if you cross this line, we're going to do X, and then they cross that line and you don't do X, you look like a wimp and your credibility is down. And so during the last gas attack in 2013, Trump was very critical of the way Obama behaved, making idle threats. And so he didn't want to do the same thing. He has to show that he's not a hypocrite and that he would be tough. The other thing is, and this is geopolitical, if you want to see these, they call it four-dimensional chess or what have you. Trump is meeting with the president of China today, tonight, when it's daytime in Japan. And Xi Jinping has kind of been brushing him off on North Korea. And Trump, in their belief, they think the sanctions can't work on North Korea because China always is breaking them and allowing a huge black market and accepting refugees and assisting North Korea. And so every time they're almost broken, the Chinese come in with enough assistance to keep it sustained. When in China's interest, they want to sustain North Korea because that's their bulwark against South Korea and Japan and the United States. So they all have different interests. But Trump is saying, look, my threats are real. I don't give idle threats like Obama. Look, I'll blow up an Air Force base. He could be using that as political leverage to scare China into complying on his East Asia policy against North Korea. That may be one reason. People think he may have been bribed. I doubt it. Blackmailed, always possible, but I don't think so. I think it's more just about his own ego. He wanted to be tough where he said Obama was weak, and he wanted to use it as an opportunity to say, when I make a threat, I'm serious. So in the future, when he makes a threat, everybody's going to listen.
That sounds very plausible. I want to get into whose interests this bombing seems to serve, because it seems to me, and I'm not an expert on, geopolitics when it comes to Israel, but it seems like this bombing serves Israel's interests.
Yeah, well, Israel has done, I think, five or six airstrikes in Syria. They hover over Lebanon and fire into the areas around Damascus. They actually went in as far as Palmyra recently. That was on March 19th in Japan time, may have been 18th or 19th in the U.S. And one of their planes was shot down, and another one was damaged. So the U.S. is not alone. Israel has been doing airstrikes in Syria, and they've never attacked the terrorist groups. They've exclusively attacked the Syrian army and the Syrian government's positions. So that
Oh.
shows you who is really interested in getting rid of the Syrian government are the Israelis. And this entire Syrian war was written out in Israeli policy papers. From Clean Break to Oded Yunnan, they've been yapping about Syria the whole time. If you want me to, I can explain
Yeah, go
the
into
Lebanon.
that.
Okay, so Oded Yunnan wrote a plan, which has been translated into English, for Greater Israel, basically. And they're saying how stage one will be Iraq. This whole thing is they want to break up Iraq, Syria, Iran, all the resistance nexus towards Israeli expansion. So Hezbollah is supported by Iran. Hezbollah defends Lebanon from Israeli aggression, and Iraq was supporting the Palestinians, and so they wanted to break that nexus up. So at the time, Iran and Iraq are fighting each other in a war where the U.S. aided both sides. The Ba'athist regime was propped up by the CIA to help fight the communists. A lot of things, but the Israelis, back in 2005. There was the assassination of the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri. And it was blamed on the Syrians because Syria, since Yom Kippur, has had troops inside Lebanon to help defend Lebanon. Bashar al-Assad's father actually fought the Israelis in the 70s and regained 30% of the Golan Heights, which is territory that the Israelis have annexed from Syria in the 1967 war. And so they're there with Hezbollah defending Lebanon. After the Rafik Hariri assassination, because of American world pressure, Assad Jr. was forced to withdraw their troops from Lebanon. So in 2006, after the troops from Syria left, Israel thought they could have a one-on-one with the Lebanese, and the replacement government wasn't going to lift a finger. So they had a war. And just Hezbollah defended Lebanon. The Lebanese military, there were no Lebanese aircraft, tanks, or anything. Only Hezbollah was fighting with the Israelis. The Israelis thought they would squash them. But that's not what happened because the Israelis aren't used to shooting at people who can fire back. They're used to pummeling little kids throwing rocks and that sort of thing. And as soon as they had some casualties, everyone's out in the street, ove, and they gave up. They lost that war. And they said, we didn't soften Syria up enough. The troops left on paper, but a lot of Syrian troops were crossing the border and helping defend Lebanon still. And then, of course, the money and guns and things are coming from Iran. Why wouldn't it be? Because that's the front line. Israel will go after them, too. Stuxnet, a lot of rhetoric against Iran coming from the Israelis. Of course, Iraq, that entire war is from the Israelis. You have the Office of Special Plans set up in the Defense Department. Every single one of them made up, comprised of Israeli Jews, Israeli partisans with Zionist ideology, who cooked up and fabricated lies about Iraq. You had Niger forgeries through Michael Ledeen. You had Douglas Feith and Richard Perle and working with Miller and Libby to lie about anthrax, mobile weapons labs, and William Sapphire about the chemical weapons under Saddam's palaces. All of these things were not true, by the way. So they topple Iraq. Next phase, they get Syria out of Lebanon. Next phase, we're going to have to weaken Syria. The U.S. tries to get in. Congress says no. So they went to a proxy war, just like they did in Iran-Contra to Nicaragua. We'll just hire a bunch of mercenaries, which is what they've done with al-Qaeda groups. We'll give them the surplus weapons from Libya that Gaddafi had stockpiled, and we'll push Assad out like that. So that was plan B. Then the Russians came in and started defending the Syrians, and they realized we can't really win this war. So we'll try and balkanize Syria, and we'll give a piece to the Kurds, and we'll give a piece to this group and that group, and that was going to be the next plan, just as long as they can. You know, you got a struggling interest here. The MIC just wants the war to go on as long as possible so they can keep making profits. The Israelis are really pushing to say, we don't want to break Syria. And they are helping these Wahhabi groups, and they always have. This Saudi Zionist alliance goes back all the way to 1976 when the Safari Club was created. And this is a group that helped fund the Mujahideen. Not helped. They funded the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the early 80s. And through BCI and
yeah, Brzezinski, he brags about doing that.
Yeah, well, the whole thing was set up by George Bush Sr. as the DCI of the CIA. He brings the Saudis into their wing because of the OPEC weapon. You know, they had gas shortage after the Yom Kippur War in 1973. So they broke up OPEC by bringing Saudi Arabia into their field of influence and said, you're going to be on this team now. And they also wanted to increase oil production because that was going to hurt the Soviet Union since Russia is an oil exporter. So the number of reasons politically that they wanted, in it sort of in American interest, that they wanted to bring the Saudis in on their side. And then they used these Wahhabi fanatics to fight the evil atheists of the communism. They're associated together. And so these Wahhabis were, you know, and these hardcore Christian and Jewish zealots were using religion to motivate people to fight the Soviets, which is a much easier argument to sell than actually explaining that why the economics of communism is so terrible. People
don't
get
communism
that.
Is inherently evil. It's a, you know, it's a bit more of a,
yeah,
it's more complicated
work.
Argument.
It's harder to convey to someone than they don't believe in Jesus or, you know, that's
yeah,
enough or Muhammad
similar.
Or whatever. So, and Saudi Arabia has a vested interest in pumping out religious fanatics because their entire kingdom rests on that. I mean, why would you have a king? It's the divine right of kings or sultan or what have you. It cannot exist without this religious belief, really. So they have overlapping interests. And this is when the CIA starts building up these madras schools to brainwash the youth into becoming Wahhabi cannon fodder that they can use all over the world. And in Afghanistan, it was great because they liberated the opium, which replaced the opium they lost in Vietnam when they were forced out of Vietnam. They replaced, you know, they just swapped the Golden Triangle and Golden Crescent, and they still have a fresh opium crop for heroin and narcotics traffic, which is very important because that is the off-the-books revenue that the CIA can use to pay for all these illegal activities and still maintain that plausible deniability. I know that was a mouthful, but that brings us up to today, basically, because we're still in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Again, you know, we went back to Afghanistan, still controlling. They stopped policing opium in 2009, or the order went in. It really didn't start happening until 2010. And then, of course, the deaths from heroin and opium-based morphine and all the great things that come from that plant are way up, including in the United States. basically an epidemic in Europe, hasn't benefited Afghanistan at all. It's not like they're rolling in money from this. The CIA is controlling the drug trade.
Yeah.
And they set up a puppet government in Afghanistan, you know, with Karzai and his brother is working for U.S. Mercenary groups. And so this also fosters a hatred of the United States throughout the part of the world, rightly so. I mean, they're helping the Northern Alliance rape little boys in Afghanistan. They're hardly any better or worse than the Taliban. And so you get these tribal groups fighting, and you foster sectarian violence, and which causes a conflict, which causes profit for the military-industrial complex, and it allows for a lot of money laundering. And that is how they pay for these proxy armies. And when they can't have it, when the proxy army, you can't trust them with the big guns, then you just hire private armies like Blackwater or Z Triple Canopy, which was done in Iraq.
Okay, well, why don't we go into a little bit about, you know, the interests, the Israeli interests, the AIPAC. How does it, like, spell that out for us? Because I know, I think that these people are whispering into Trump's ear. I think they're, you know, Machiavelli in their, the way they operate. I think they are doing everything they can. You know, they seem to, like, they seem to be like a snake that's, you know, encircled the whole of the United States government, especially the Pentagon. And
they're very organized. And the AIPAC is the most powerful lobby, hands down, because it has state sponsorship. Other lobbies have to raise money from their members. And AIPAC can get money from Israel. And all their United Friends for fill-in-the-blank, something-something Friends of Israel, are just these – it's all these little subgroups under AIPAC is sort of the umbrella – like an umbrella corporation for a bunch of little subsidiaries. And they're all just lobbying for Israeli interests. But when I say Israeli interests, it's not really in the interest of the common Israeli dude walking down Tel Aviv or something. It's in the state's interests and their state's ideology, which is inherently racist and fanatically religious in most regards, with the settlements and annexing land and thinking God's a real estate agent. But there are a lot of economic reasons that hide behind that. Now, the common person might be more manipulated by the religious aspect, but there are definitely some shekel motives involved as well. Like the for a long time, you know, after the overthrow of Iran, Israel was getting 90% of its oil from Iran and the Sinai Peninsula there in Egypt. And that got abruptly shut off once Iran had its revolution in 1979. So oil needs, they need a replacement. Ironically, a pipeline that Iran and Israel built together, which stretches across the southern part of Israel up, so it touches the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, it's been used as an alternative to the Suez Canal when Egypt used to turn that off and on at a whim. So the Brits and the Americans and people interested in the Suez Canal, as is one of the major choking points of oil, have this pipeline in Israel, and Israel enjoys that great middleman status of having oil flow through that to the Red Sea, because all that oil going to Asia, to India, to China, has to pass through Israel. And so what they'd set up as a non-OPEC source of gas and oil from the Caspian Sea was out of Azerbaijan, which I call Little BP, because British Petroleum owns that country, basically. It goes from Azerbaijan through the little states to Turkey, where it hits a port, and then from there it goes by boat to Israel, slides through their pipe, and then it can be shipped east. Japan, South Korea, China, India, etc. A huge Asian market, very thirsty for oil. So Turkey benefits from that, and Azerbaijan, of course, benefits from that. Georgia benefits from that, and Israel does. However, once the troops were removed from Iraq at the end of that war, they immediately signed on to a pipeline deal with Iran and Syria to build a $10 billion pipeline, which would take gas from the Pars fields in Iran, which has conflict with Qatar, because Qatar and Iran are both draining this same area, and would go up through to Syria, where it can hit a port, hit the Mediterranean, and they could sell gas and oil to Europe that way without having to use the Turkish line and without having to pass through the line in Israel. Because another thing that happened was there was a revolution in Egypt. They reopened the Suez Canal, and states like Libya started saying, well, we'll just send our oil east directly through the Suez Canal. We don't have to send it through Israel. Well, they didn't like that very much. So suddenly, the all of Europe is attacking Libya. And then everybody's ganged up on Syria. Well, Syria's got very large, or had a very large anti-air defense. So they needed ground forces, but they don't want to get skin in the game. So the proxy forces have been there. And they've been greatly allied by Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. Qatar has its conflicts with Iran. Turkey had its oil interests, and then they got caught. I mean, the Russians found the Turks getting just a whole caravan of trucks filled with oil that ISIS was sending into Turkey, and the Russians blew it up. But that was that they wanted Syria's oil, and they were getting it. They're not getting it now. The Russians took out the tankers. And so there are a lot of energy interests as well as religious interests, but the Turkey or Saudi Arabia, as powerful as they are, could not get the U.S. and Europe on board. Israel can. When it was in Israel's interest is when it actually happens.
Well, it's interesting because I think there's a lot of dual citizens in working in the United States government. You know, what I mean by dual citizens is Israeli and American, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like people like Bill Kristol, I don't know if he's a dual citizen. I imagine he is.
He is, actually. He has family in Israel. William Kristol is a co-founder of the PNAC group with Robert Kagan. And, you know, Victoria Nuland's his wife. She was involved in Ukraine and financing Nazis up there. And they lied about Iraq. Robert Kagan did. William Kristol did. And the Weekly Standard, which was their media outfit, got its seed money from Lockheed Martin. So these kind of dual citizen media outfit pairs up with a large aerospace industry. But then you look at what was Lockheed Martin's largest project? What did they spend the most money on of all their aircraft and everything they've ever built? The F-35, like no close competitor. $1.5 trillion. And it's a piece of crap. And it was jointly built in Israel, which is why it's so expensive, partially why.
Well, and it just seems like, honestly, I think they are traitors who've infiltrated the United States government and should probably be tried for treason.
All of them should be like Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, Elliot Abrams, Kristol, Kagan, Libby. Or Leibowitz is his real name. All these people that were the principal architects for the war in Iraq should be in prison, minimal. And all their compadres. I mean, Wolfowitz's sister lives there. Feith's partner in Feith and Zell is an Israeli settler. They set up these equity firms, Perle and Feith did. And they're profiting off of the war industry. And it's a huge conflict of interest because Richard Perle was the chairman of the Defense Planning Board in the DOD. He was the secretary for policy there. And he's profiting off the A-22 and all these different, you know, suggested projects that these aerospace companies are getting billions of dollars for. It's a total conflict of interest. And of course, they wanted war. You can profit from any war. They specifically wanted war in Iraq because that's what Israel wanted. They were screaming about it in their policy papers. They were afraid of Iraq. Iraq was stronger than Syria, and they needed to take Iraq out first, followed by Syria. And it's happened. And you can rewind, and people say, oh, it was the petrodollar, or we're fighting for oil or whatever. The EU and the euro and that didn't exist when the propaganda against Saddam Hussein began. And all they did after 9/11 was recycle lies that they had already said back in 1997, 98, same people, same lies. They recycled them, and it worked. And so it wasn't like Saddam was getting off the dollar to go on the euro because the euro didn't even exist. They went after Saddam because that was what was in Israel's interests. And they wrote out why. He was helping Palestinians.
What is the greater overarching plan? Does Israel want to take over the entire Middle East? Is that their plan? Or according to these policy papers,
they don't want any challenge economically or militarily to their regional hegemony. They want complete control over the area, and they want to annex more land as well. They want to physically expand their borders. And they've been doing that very slowly in the West Bank. They've taken the Golan Heights. They've taken pieces of Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and almost all of Palestine. And their borders just seem to be mobile. They built a wall. The wall's not even on their border. It cuts into the West Bank, so they've annexed some more territory. All the between the demarcation line and the wall, all that territory is effectively Israeli now.
That's funny, because they were talking about the wall, you know, when Trump brought up his idea for a wall, that was horrible, horrible and racist. But they can have a wall. They, you know, nationalism for me, Goy, but not for you.
I mean, Trump's wall wasn't even about race. It it was just having a territorial integrity, a cultural integrity, like to stop illegal immigration. Illegal immigration is illegal. I think you could stop illegal immigration a lot easier by getting rid of the benefits.
Well, sure.
But
then,
know,
the, and then, you know,
I just... NAFTA would help, too.
Israel drives me up the wall because they're the absolute hypocrites. Absolute disgusting hypocrites because, you know, you know, you're racist, you're bad. You know what? Europeans, you have to take all these immigrants. You have to take all the migrants. Take them, Goy. Take them. Oh, but you don't want to? You're a racist.
Well, worse than that, Israel profits from that because the United Israel Appeal actually gets paid to assist refugees. It started with Jewish refugees. The Jewish Agency set this up. That's who did the Vera Agreement, by the way, working with the Nazis. They get money from the state to relocate refugees, but they're not just helping Jewish refugees. They're helping put Muslim or whatever, any Middle Eastern refugees in Europe, not into Israel. So they're making money off all these refugees.
Yeah, and they're guilting the Western countries for not taking enough, and they're not taking a single goddamn one. And it it's absolutely fucking disgusting.
The Middle East is absorbed the most. Like Jordan is flooded with refugees. Turkey's flooded with refugees. But at least they have some common cultural ties.
Yeah, it makes things a lot easier to integrate, and it causes less. When you have a bunch of people who don't have the same culture, the same ideas on how to live, different culture, different just...
It'll end up like Israel because that's basically what Palestine did, was take a bunch of European refugees because there are a bunch of Europeans that say they're Hebrew, a bunch of blue-eyed Jews that go down to Palestine and say, this is mine, God gave it to me. That God is not a real estate agent, and states have the right to force their immigrants to assimilate to their culture, their language, and absorb them, and it's better for labor and everything else. When you just have floods of refugees with third world ideas, it just drags the first world down. I mean, you cannot economically sustain an influx of people who can't speak the common language and expect them to be working right away. No matter how smart they were before, they could have been a doctor, whatever. If you come to Germany and you can't speak German or English, what are they supposed to do with you?
And the worst part is the cultural Marxism, because here's the thing. If you expect these people to assimilate, then you're a racist. Then you're this. Then you're that. You know, it's...
What about the United States? The United States is full of a bunch of different races anyway. You still have to assimilate.
Well, it's not
like they're specifically against Mexicans, but they're okay with everything else. Like,
yeah,
it's so silly.
Well, the policy that Trump wanted was, you know, he wanted illegal immigrants out. It was illegal immigrants. He wasn't saying Mexicans got to go. He was saying this.
Well, people are so polarized on that immigration issue because a lot of immigrants will come in, and some of them are exploited for labor. Like corporations will pay them under the table, and they get exploited. Others will come and have 15 kids and reap all the benefits from the United States welfare system.
They do that everywhere.
Both things are true. There are people who come and use the system and suck. There are other people who come and work their ass off and just get used by the man. Both situations are true, but people just look at the side that they want to. The thing is, it's problems all around to have illegal immigrants. That's why they need to make legal immigration easier and get rid of some of the incentives to come illegally, which would be also, you'd have to look at the trade policies that have devastated the Mexican economy, like NAFTA, which Trump did oppose. He opposed NAFTA. I don't know what his reasons were, but if he does the right thing for the wrong reason, he's still doing the right thing. But you have to worry about him now because he could pull a complete 180 on Syria.
Yeah.
He was bombing al-Nusra. He was killing terrorists. 66 days without CIA assistance and ISIS was falling apart. They pulled this stunt, a stunt that Trump had criticized in the past. He had been skeptical in the past about the gas attacks. And he's up there making his speech about the children and the children and children
yeah,
and children.
Yeah, that's just anytime a politician does that, that's pretty much – they're just lying.
It just reminds me of Giuliani going, 9-11, I was there at 9-11.
Yeah.
He was 911 times. He's wrecked his credibility with the American people. Even if he thinks, well, now the Chinese will listen to me because I look like my threats are real – no one will believe you ever, because Syria was the main reason a lot of people picked him over Hillary, because they were both trash. But at least Trump had an America First policy. And
yeah, and his campaign was based on putting American interests first, not having ridiculous interventionist foreign policy. You know, as numerous interviews where he said, we can't be nation building, we can't do that. And now here he is.
He criticized the invasion of Libya. He criticized the war in Afghanistan. He said the Syrian thing was all wrong. Let the Russians handle them. He said about the moderate rebels, if you keep doing that, you're fighting a war on two fronts. You can't fight Assad and fight the rebels at the same time. It's stupid. You've spent $6 trillion in the Middle East. This is stuff he said to Jeb Bush when he metaphorically crumpled him up and shoved him in a locker.
Yeah.
Once he gets in there and he sees the reality of the situation, because Washington, everyone around him, and you got Senator McCain and you've got the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who are perfect buddies, saying things like, we need to take out the Syrian Air Force. That's what Hillary was just saying. And Trump goes and takes out 15 of their aircraft. He's acting like Hillary Clinton, which is, I'm telling you, the majority of votes for Trump were votes against Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Mostly. And if he continues to slide towards the neocons, he will have no base, because the social justice faggots will never support him. The neocons will never support him. And he's wiping out his base, because the anti-war folks, or the people who just wanted to stop spending so much money in pointless military adventures, those are the people concerned about jobs, and say, well, look, that's what resonated with people who voted for him. They want to renegotiate trade deals. They want the jobs back. They want their taxes lowered. He was talking about the economy.
Secure the border.
Secure the border and get rid of Obamacare. And they already shot down health care so far. He was working on the tax plan. Now they have this disaster in Syria. I mean, the quickest way to save money is stop spending it on stupid things like going to war for Israel. There's $1 trillion you can save right there.
No, it's definitely – you know, it's funny. I want to actually get into how did we get here, Ryan? How did we get here to the point? Because Israel wasn't always in charge of the foreign policy of the United States. So how did that transformation happen?
It started in 1963 on November 23rd, the day after Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah?
Israel had their boy in the White House under LBJ. That's who gave us the USS Liberty. He was sleeping with her Irgun terrorist, Matilda Krim. Zionists had LBJ by the short hairs because of the Kennedy assassination. And that is where, once they're in, you're only talking about a couple generations. Like, guys like Kissinger are still here. And we're in that Johnson administration as an advisor and everything else. And now he's still advising, you know. Rumsfeld was a young tyke back then. Gerald Ford becomes president, who was on the Warren Commission. You know, several Warren Commission people end up in very prominent positions, and you see that all these young neocons from this Swoop Jackson Democrats and the like followers of Leon Strauss are all over the Kennedy assassination. And so we're just dealing with the second generation of kooks from that group who embedded themselves when Johnson became president and was appointing people left and right. And we got stuck with permanent Zionist judges. We got the main policies that were reversed from Kennedy. It wasn't Vietnam. It wasn't Cuba. It wasn't Africa. It was the Middle East. That's when you get the Six-Day War. Robert Kennedy is assassinated on the anniversary of the Six-Day War, the first anniversary of the Six-Day War, 1968, because it happened in 67, that on June 5th, they assassinated Robert Kennedy, and it was blamed on a Palestinian, Sirhan Sirhan. But that's not who did it.
Well, yeah, he's funny. He actually says he was mind controlled or something to do something like that. Sirhan Sirhan?
Yeah, Sirhan Sirhan was in debt to the mob, like 20 grand from betting on horses and things. And so more than likely he wasn't mind controlled. He was just drugged out of his mind and didn't know what he was doing. I think Eugene Caesar shot him. I mean, Sirhan Sirhan is saying, well, he took his 8-shot revolver in front of Kennedy, shot it 13 times and hit him 3 times in the back. I mean, it's a ridiculous story. If the internet had existed back then, that would have been debunked immediately. John Pilger, who's the Australian journalist, made so many great documentaries. He was there. He was in the kitchen. Like, the guy next to him was shot, got hit by one of the bullets. He's behind Sirhan Sirhan, and the guy next to him is shot. I mean, the shot's coming from that way, from behind Robert Kennedy. I'm doing a big Kennedy documentary about what happened to both of them, who all did it and all. It would take me for, I'm not avoiding that question. It's so much stuff
to
say.
No, I understand. But
quick answer
is,
when did the Zionists gain control? Right after Kennedy was killed. That's when they got in.
That's
why people need to understand that. If you understand the Kennedy assassinations, plural, and Iran-Contra, then when 9/11 comes, it won't even be a shock. And then Syria. Syria is a copy of Iran-Contra. Almost the same everything. And yeah, I mean, 9/11, you've seen my documentaries on that, so you know my feelings. But
well,
it's all the same people.
It's funny. I just find it annoys me. I don't like hypocrisy. And I notice it's always like Zionist types telling, you know, because they're the most ethno-nationalist people out there.
Oh, yeah. They can have guns, but you can't.
Like I said, nationalism for me, Goy, but not for ye. And it just it's disgusting. And, you know, it's funny, even Rebel Media, they did a little video poo-pooing white nationalism. And here's the thing. I don't have a problem with ethno-nationalism for any group. If you're black, if you want to be a black nationalist, that's great. If you want white and you want to be a white nationalist, that's great. If you're Jew and you want to be a Jew nationalist, that's great. But, you know, don't be a douche about it. And don't be a lying hypocrite.
Mm-hmm. I don't support ethnic nationalism, but I am opposed to hypocrisy because, you know, it is something else for the Israelis to support racial apartheid and segregated schools and roads. And you're talking about real apartheid. And then turn around and call somebody a racist because they oppose illegal immigration. I'm against illegal immigration, and I'm not an ethnic nationalist. I just don't agree with illegal immigration. And they want to call someone like me a racist for that position because I don't see illegal immigration as economically feasible. And yet they have a straight-up racial apartheid where, I mean, they can arrest Africans just for the crime of being outside at night. Things like that. And look, folks have a right to keep their cultural integrity. In my opinion, though, I just don't think that that's genetic. I think it's a culture is culture. It's based on ideas and people can assimilate. There are people in America who are not European or just as American and diehard, like, you know, believe in American ideology as anyone else around them.
Well, here's the thing. I think as far as like the whole ethno-nationalism, I think it's kind of natural to just want to congregate with others like yourself who are like you, right? I think there's an ingrained human characteristic. And, you know, a lot of times that who you perceive to be like you will be people who have the same ethnic background as you. And I don't, you know, I'm going to disagree with
probably you. Probably as a kid, but like, I would get along more with Ron Paul or Thomas Sowell, one black guy, one white guy, than I am some Irish Native American neocon. You know, like the idea is what matters to me.
Sure, but I'm just thinking of humanity as a broad spread. Because if you look at all, if humanity, humanity has been very tribal. Humanity has been very, you know what I mean? It's evolutionary. It makes sense, evolutionarily speaking, to have a tighter in-group with your tribe. Who are genetically like you because you, because those people who had that tight in group preference would probably survive competitions with groups, or be more likely to survive competitions with groups who didn't have as tight of an in-group preference.
I don't know. I mean, I think that biologically people will have that tendency, but you can just reason out your way out of that and say, yeah, well, I'm driven this way biologically, but you can get above your biology through reason. It's good to network with everybody. I think that's what the Italians did by bringing in other Europeans and made a society that gathered ideas from all around them was very advantageous to be inclusive rather than exclusive. And the groups that are exclusive end up falling way behind. You know, I mean, Japan is a good group of an example of a very homogeneous society, but they're very parasitical to gathering ideas from other places like the United States, et cetera. But the biggest factor in whether or not your civilization is going to thrive or not is, do you have capitalism? I mean, if you don't, it doesn't matter. If you have communism, it could be the USSR, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, it could be North Korea. It doesn't matter what race you are, you're going to fail because it doesn't work. Like, having patent laws and copyrights does motivate people to share their ideas. And the more the merrier. And having different ways of thinking lets you tackle problems differently. But yeah, market solutions and capitalism are by far the greater factor in pushing society forward, more so than looking like your neighbor.
Well, I'll tell you what. Markets are, you know, they're definitely preferable because they definitely, you know, they just work. And there's, you know, we can go into the economics of why, you know, central planning, it doesn't work because there's not enough information. The central planners don't have enough information to they don't have the information to efficiently allocate resources to everybody. And human needs are infinite, and resources are finite. Now, but I will say to you, there's been stuff done that when you're in a multicultural society, Ryan, trust goes down. When you're in a homogeneous society, it's a higher trust society.
Could be. I think there's some other reasons for that, too.
I'm just talking about correlation. I don't know if that's the underlying cause. I would bet that it is. But these are, you know, this is fuck, I could pull this up. I wasn't expecting to have this conversation right now.
I think when you're in it with just like two groups or something, they will mesh better than if you're getting like 9 or 10 different cultures in one area. You end up with a lot of violence like the United States. But in some other places, you know, whether it's...
I think you can have immigration. I think you can have other people come in, but they have to... Number one, the majority society, the majority demographic needs to needs to stay the majority, and two, there has to be an expectation of assimilation.
Yeah, especially with language, because when you start getting different language groups, you really screw things up. When you have the same language group, like the Irish and the British, even though they don't get along over there, get along fine in the United States.
Well, like I
said, once you adopt the culture.
I do think multiculturalism is horrible. I think it's destroying civilizations. And like I said, I think you can have immigration. I think you can have other people come in. But I do believe strongly that groups act differently when they're in the minority than when they're in the majority.
A big problem with multiculturalism is it's like unconditional equality between cultures. It's fine to have different cultures that work, but some cultures suck and they don't want to admit that. They go, oh no, we're all equal and everything's the same and equally valid.
Cultural relativism.
True. Cultural relativism is a farce. Like, I'm going to go with Western science. I'm going to go with a lot of things that seem to produce results. I'm going to go with free markets and so on. And so, yeah, you can compare like South Korea and Japan or whatever culturally. They can mesh because they're pretty even idea-wise on, you know, their thoughts about medicine or whatever, you know, architecture, et cetera. They have different philosophies and things, but they're, you know, not, you know, falling into religious superstition or theocracy or something like some other cultures, which those kind of cultures are inferior. And, that, you know, they – based on the results they produce. Like if based on life expectancy, that's something you can measure, like how long you're going to live, how an infant mortality rate or something. Soap and, you know, the Western medicine work. You can't just like say, well, in my culture to do it this way and the baby dies. You're stating yourself that your value is of life and health, and yet your actions do not produce those results. It means your culture is wrong. And that is a word you cannot say. You can't say wrong and right with relativists.
No, you can't. I do think that certain groups are more inclined to certain cultures. Liberty seems to be a Western ideal. You know, I get that we've, on the West, we've fallen from that. But I don't think there's been any other society that's really put liberty into a cognitive, codified system. And you know what? Liberty in the West has not been perfect, and I'll be the first to admit that. But there's a difference between the theoretical and putting something into practice. And when you put a theoretical idea into practice, it's always going to be flawed.
Mm. Well, you can see it started that way in the earth we have it. You know, Western Europe is on the coast, so they're going to develop a lot faster than Eastern Europe because of sea trade, which is also the exchange of ideas, and that leads to physics and so on. But you take places like Singapore, which was a backwards shithole for a long time. They adopt a free market. They get a unified language. They said, you're going to be speaking English, and you're going to do these markets, and they have turned things around and are one of the fastest growing nations in Asia and making more money than some European states. North and South Korea, same language, same culture, vastly different outcome, regardless of the racial makeup, regardless of the linguistic makeup.
Well, I don't doubt that when other groups put...
But it's not like they are inclined to be communist just in the North and not in the South because of their genetics. Like,
no, I don't say that, but
communism was a Western idea, too. I mean, that's what came from Europe and was a plague on Earth. Capitalism was a better idea that came.
Well, some would say that it's has more of a Semitic influence.
It did. It did, but it was Semites from Europe, so... But, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, you're going to have the marginalized groups in Europe are going to be more attracted to communism because communism is a sort of equalizer, you know, in theory. And so you have to see that, like, Christian bigots have been really hard. They wouldn't allow Jews to own land or own or have certain occupations.
That's why they went into finance.
It really boomeranged to bite them back in the ass.
It really did, didn't
like,
it?
Fine, we'll get into banking and this and that. And those were at the time, banking wasn't a big deal.
No. You know,
people would trade just without even using paper. We know how it happened. But communism is a terrible idea, but it's very attractive even now to the youth and the people who've never worked in the real world.
Well, it's also been romanticized. Like, I was going to do a video on this later, but... There's a fucking Pepsi commercial where they're like glorifying like Idle No More, not Idle No More. It's a occupied, you know, typical left wing activism. So you can see how this degenerate, horrible left wing, just wrong on everything, activism is promoted by the corporate media. And I made a joke that the People's Revolution won't only be televised; it's sponsored by Pepsi.
Well, Pepsi and ITT, not AT&T, ITT and Pepsi actually sponsored a coup by the CIA.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Guatemala, yeah.
But so. it's hilarious because you look at what's happening with Marvel, like their comic books, I guess. I read a story the other day, their CEO saying that they've been trying to push all this identity politics in their comic books, I guess, and it's backfired and bit them in the ass. And then
it really sank because it's funny in the movies. I'm big in this. I know this stuff. Marvel, in Captain America: Winter Soldier. We're gonna nerd out here. They actually started saying some things against the military-industrial complex. They actually had some libertarian ideals, saying, "Well, we don't need this Registration Act, which is kind of like the Patriot Act, and so on." And what if the government just uses us as, you know, their personal army for their personal ends? We can't sign up for this. And so you see that in the third Captain America as well. But in the comic books, they got really PC. They just started revamping all these different heroes under different ethnic groups for no reason. It didn't really change the story at all. It was just done for the sake of it. And no one liked it. It's It's silly. Like, you could tell it was just done for the sake of it, and they sacrificed story writing. But that, you know, because Disney bought Marvel, and so their comic books went downhill. They allowed, because Disney wants to make money, they let Marvel have creative control of the movies, and the movies did very well. But they tried to. We got like a Puerto Rican Spider-Man and all. And it's just, what are you doing? Like,
Well, the thing is they're trying
just make a new hero. Don't take over an old one. You
No,
know, like
but here's the
Thor
thing.
has to be Aryan. It doesn't make sense to change Thor.
But the thing is
Like,
they're using these as a vehicle to promote their agenda, and it's not the only example of it's just one that comes off top of my head right now. But you know, this corporate America is promoting this culturally Marxist and some ways economically it's weird. It's like cultural Marxism with kind of like a corporate edge. It's really weird, but they're promoting
but it
it.
started with having a gay Teletubby, if you remember back then, on the children's show.
No, the
It's
thing is, these CEOs, they go to these universities and they're indoctrinated with these ideas, and they carry these ideas out into their world and they promulgate them. You know, the all the Ivy League schools, they promote this culture of you know, this hatred of Western civilization, this pathological altruism, this egalitarian nonsense, and this idea that you know Western civilization is wrong and is bad and flawed, and we have to destroy it
So
through
antithetical to their
globalism.
other beliefs, though, because they say, like, everyone agree, all right, slavery is wrong, sexism wrong, like, okay, obviously, but it's Western civilization that ended slavery. It's Western
Yes.
civilization that went around and forced the ending of slavery all around the rest of the world, and they'll just focus on like a particular aspect of slavery in the United States or something. But it's the West and the British that went around and policed and stopped the slave ships. It was Thomas Jefferson that ended the Atlantic slave trade. It was, and the same thing for sexism. The very first place to have women's suffrage was New Zealand, and it spread through the West first before it, and it still hasn't penetrated the Middle East.
Now, don't get
But
me
any
don't get me
slavery, any
started on women's
sexism,
suffrage.
that all starts from the West. Then it goes overboard with third wave feminism, where,
I don't know,
I
man.
mean, it's males that are getting circumcised in our country, not females. They're the ones getting a piece of the dick chopped off. I mean, for what? Because it's aesthetically pleasing to the girl or something? I mean, that's the kind of power they have. Like, we're gonna chop a piece of your baby's cock off. And also, it's a line item on the for the medical industry. It's something else they can charge people for. So they tell them, oh, this is, you know, for
Health.
urinary tract infections or something. It isn't. I mean, obviously, billions of people, like where I live, right? It's 120 million people. They don't chop off their babies' penises and foreskins, and they're not having all these health problems.
No, it was it, the
It's
argument
most, it's
was
a
it
very
goes way
political
back a
part of
long
being
time.
too, and getting rid of that for them. So
Yeah.
it's fucked up.
Well, the thing is,
Violent.
it is. But the thing is, the whole women's suffrage thing, that's when socialism started to happen, you see, because women, they vote more for socialism. Because you know, bless their hearts, they have that need in
I
them.
didn't mean just voting rights. Like, women should be allowed to drive, which they can't in Saudi Arabia, and women should be allowed to work besides teacher and a nurse, you know? Like, and then, of course, they should be allowed to vote. But the motives for why women were finally allowed to vote wasn't because they thought, oh, well, they're equal and smart and should be allowed to vote. It's because they see most of them are just going to copy their husband's vote, and most of them are going to vote like through this sort of socialist agenda. And so they want block voting. You hear them talk about like the female vote. I'm like, what are you talking about? Girls are all different from each other. How can you think they're all going to vote a certain way? Or the black community? Like, what are you talking about, the black community? Would you say the white community? You think that all white people are going
Have
to
you looked
think
at
this
the demographics of
thing?
the voting demographics from the last election
I
in the
know, like,
states? They do. People do vote in chunks.
they do
People
vote
vote.
in
They
chunks
vote on based on
because
their sex and
they do,
their race. They vote
because
based
they're
on their
given special
genetics.
rights. If the government says, you know, we're going to increase the special rights for fill in the blanks, then the fill in the blanks realize, look, we can vote ourselves money, so we'll vote for that party.
That's part of it, I
That's
think, but I think they're voting for
a lot of it.
they're voting for their what they perceive are their interests.
Right, but it's, I mean, like, others divide between liberal, conservative, libertarian, whatever. So why doesn't that happen in these other groups? I mean, 95% of African Americans vote Democrat, but why? Why do they think Democrats are in their interests? They're clearly not
Well,
in their
because
interests.
they're tribal.
Right, tribalist.
Human beings are very tribal, and I think the thing with libertarians is we need to realize that every other human being, I think this individualist is a product of Western civilization, is only manifests strongly in Western man, and the expectation that we can have other people manifest it is a little ethnocentric. It's thinking that we have that our ideas are so good that we have to force them on everyone else, and that everyone should just accept them. I disagree with that. I think that our ideas work for us, and maybe other people's ideas work better for them.
I think you can get political tribalism too. I mean, it's the same way most people vote the way their parents voted, kind of thing. And
Sure.
they have the religion that their parents had, and they have the political party that their parents had. And so, way back when, they thought, well, the Democrats are the ones that started desegregation. So, we're just going to support them no matter what. It's that simple. But what you said could also make sense. Can't prove it one way or the other because
No,
both of them.
I can't prove it, but it's something I've really come to believe because I just look at every other group. They're so tribal. And the only universalist people I meet are generally white Westerners. And that's just because it's.
I see a lot of tribalism too. I mean,
Oh yeah,
I
you've
will
got
agree
yeah,
with
they've
you on
got
that.
we've
Just from
got
my
some tribalism.
observations, you'll see, like, I was at a Palestinian rally, right? It's full of Palestinians and some white guys. I go to a thing for Syria, I go to a thing for Africa, and it's the group that's being affected and a few white people. I rarely see the Syrian activists talking about Sierra Leone or something, and I rarely see the African talking about North Korea or something. It's just Koreans talking about it, right? And a few white people. So the universalists are mainly from Western society, and I think mainly from the United States. And I think they're mainly whites because the United States is mostly white also.
All
It's a
right, buddy.
result.
Well, thanks for coming on. I'll get this edited and I'll send it to you or whatever. All
Cool. All
right, see you,
right,
bud.
well, see you.
See ya.
Thanks.
All right, thank you for watching. If you liked this video, please give it a like and please subscribe to the channel. Also, take some time to check out my video titled Operation Leonidas: The Fall of Europe. I'm going to be traveling to Europe with Augustus Invictus, publisher of The Revolutionary Conservative, to document exactly what's happening in Europe with the migrant crisis. We'll be traveling into the no-go zones and the ghettos to get a first-hand look at the migrant invasion and decline of Europe. Please consider donating to the project. All right, I'm Richard Heathen with LibertyMachineNews.com. Thank you for watching.